So long, Rex. Today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Rex Tillerson's tenure at the State Department ends abruptly with a presidential tweet. His replacement has a lot of work to do.
I think we've looked at probably the weakest State Department, the most demoralized State Department in the last 40 to 50 years. That's all on Secretary Tillerson.
Also, a journalist writes about the sexual assault she experienced as a teenager in Mecca and hears from Muslim women around the globe.
Indonesian women saying, yes, this happened to me. Muslim women in India and Pakistan and Urdu. And then Muslim women in Turkey and Turkish and in the Middle East and Arabic.
And Jimmy O. Yang remembers telling his father he wanted to be a comedian.
What is that? You can't make money from that. That's not a job. You should go find a real job.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let's face it, from day one, Rex Tillerson was a controversial choice for Secretary of State, from his previous life as ExxonMobil CEO.
Prime Minister and President-elect, thank you for the warm welcome, and it is a historic day for ExxonMobil and Rosneft.
To his close ties to Vladimir Putin.
I've known him since 1999, and I have a very close relationship with him.
In the end, none of that helped Rex Tillerson keep the job. Today, President Trump announced he was firing him with a tweet. Another tweet came from Elon Goldenberg, a former State Department official under President Obama. Quote, Tillerson will go down as one of the weakest, least effective secretaries in history for two reasons. One, his terrible relationship with Trump, and two, his total mismanagement of the department, end quote. Trump's pick to replace Tillerson at State is CIA Director Mike Pompeo. More on him in a moment. We start our coverage here with Nick Burns. He's a former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. He also served as U.S. Ambassador to NATO under George W. Bush. So, Nick Burns, I want to ask you first. We've heard rumors for months that Tillerson was either frustrated and about to leave, or Trump wasn't happy and he was getting ready to fire him. Why do you think Tillerson got fired now?
Oh, I think it's clear that the president and Tillerson didn't see eye to eye on some major issues. Secretary Tillerson was a moderating voice on Iran. He did not want to see the United States leave the Iran nuclear deal. Tillerson also argued for many months that the United States ought to try diplomacy with North Korea before it thought about unilateral military action. The president took that advice just a couple of days ago, but they didn't seem to be on the same wavelength. The president clearly wants someone who he thinks will reflect his own views, and that person is Mike Pompeo.
Well, I know one of the things that's bothered you in the last year is just how much the State Department has changed under Tillerson. And a lot of people see him as the person who atrophied the State Department, leaving a lot of appointments vacant, letting people walk out the door in frustration and demoralized. Is Pompeo going to build the State Department back up?
You know, I'm not sure he will. I think Secretary Tillerson failed as manager of the State Department because he agreed with these draconian 30% budget cuts. They didn't pay attention to the senior career diplomats who have so much experience, major ambassadorial posts in places like Ankara and Berlin and Seoul went unfilled. And I think, Marco, we've looked at probably the weakest State Department, the most demoralized State Department in the last 40 to 50 years. That's all on Secretary Tillerson. If Secretary Pompeo is going to be effective, he's going to need to convince Donald Trump that diplomacy and diplomats are important.
So let's go back to that issue that you brought up, North Korea. Rex Tillerson made diplomatic overtures to North Korea. Trump shot him down publicly. Then 6 months later, Trump accepts this overture. What do you make of this one issue facing the U.S. and how Trump and Tillerson dealt with it? And what's going to be different with Mike Pompeo?
I think the president's been right to turn towards diplomacy. And I imagine that Tillerson and Mattis pushed him in that direction. It's important for Pompeo, I think, to have his confirmation hearings early and soon, because President Trump's going to need someone like Pompeo to go to Pyongyang before the summit meeting and investigate whether the North Koreans are truly serious about denuclearization, because most people suspect they're not. He's going to be a critical figure in this big decision that President Trump is going to have to make by the middle part of June, whether or not to recertify and, in effect, approve the continuation of the Iran nuclear deal. If the administration backs out of that, then, of course, Iran will have no restrictions. They'll be able to go back to a nuclear program. And I think that would really poison our relations further with the Germans, the British, and French, our closest allies, all of whom support the agreement. So Iran and North Korea become major issues for a Secretary Mike Pompeo going forward.
Assess for us whether Pompeo has what it takes to do diplomacy with Pyongyang or with Tehran. What do you think?
Oh, I think he's clearly experienced enough. He knows the world. He's been the person with the president in the daily morning briefing for most of the last 14 months. He's traveled a lot as a member of the House, was very involved in foreign policy. So I don't think experience or knowledge is the issue here. It's good for the president to have someone in whom the president has confidence. Mike Pompeo clearly has that. The Secretary of State also needs to be able to disagree with the president and not be afraid to speak truth to power when that's necessary. And I think that will be an early test.
So finally, Nick, I want to ask you about Russia, because we heard earlier Rex Tillerson expressing his warm relations with Putin and the Kremlin. Mike Pompeo, during his confirmation hearing, said that Russia, quote, has reasserted itself aggressively, invading and occupying Ukraine, threatening Europe, and doing nearly nothing to aid in the destruction and defeat of ISIS, end quote. Is Pompeo the person who's going to stare Russian aggression in the face? And is that what Donald Trump wants?
I think that that's what the administration has to do. We've seen this massive conspiracy by the Russians to undermine the elections in the United States. We believe that's continuing as the 2018 election primaries are underway. Will they be explicitly critical of the Russian government? President Trump has not done that in the last 14 months, which is shocking and objectionable. And one would hope that Secretary Pompeo, if he is confirmed, would move the president towards a tougher and more rational position, that we have to oppose the Russian government on these issues.
Nick, finally, how does today's news change the way you see diplomacy coming from the White House?
Well, unfortunately, we've seen a very weak State Department and an under-personed State Department, not supported by President Trump. One would hope that a strong Secretary of State with the president's confidence, like Mike Pompeo, would be able to argue with the president that the president has hurt the United States by not supporting a healthy, fully manned State Department, and that he really needs to turn around and reconsider these massive budget cuts.
Do you think he's going to do that? Do you think he will talk to Trump honestly and sincerely?
One would hope so, because Pompeo's had enough experience at the CIA to understand if you don't have your men and women, your career civil servants behind you. So that I think is the major test of a Secretary Pompeo, to regain the confidence of the foreign and civil servants. There's a way to do that. Believe in them, appoint them to senior positions, and turn around this irrational budget that would, I think, undercut for a generation the strength of our diplomacy.
A dramatic day in diplomacy. Former U.S. Ambassador to NATO Nicholas Burns, thanks very much for walking us through this.
Thank you, Marco.
Mike Pompeo's replacement for Director of Central Intelligence will be his current deputy. If she's confirmed, Gina Haspel will be the first woman to head the CIA. We'll dig in more to who she is in the days ahead on the show. Right now, though, today, we can assume that the CIA and many intelligence agencies are focused on the UK because of what seems to be a deliberate attempt to poison a former Russian spy living there. That's the conclusion Prime Minister Theresa May came to about the incident last week involving Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia. And May is certain Russia either was behind the attempted assassination or Russia lost control of the nerve agent and it ended up in someone else's hands. May did say incontrovertibly that it was a nerve agent that came from Russia. Simon Gass is with the London-based think tank Chatham House and is former political director of the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office. From 2013 to 16, has some real-time experience dealing with Russia. So, first of all, Simon, how seriously is Britain taking this attack?
Well, Britain is taking this very seriously. I mean, here we have an example of somebody who's been living in the United Kingdom, who should have been able to live out their life peacefully and without threat to them. And yet now we find that they have been attacked with a nerve agent, which points the finger firmly in the direction of Moscow. And of course, we shouldn't forget that this is not the first incident of this time. We had the death about a decade ago of Litvinenko, who similarly was
Alexander Litvinenko, yeah.
Who was similarly poisoned, which again clearly had Russia as its origin. So this is the second time it's happened in the UK. It's part of a wider picture of Russian aggression against the West as a whole. So the British government certainly takes this very seriously.
So Theresa May has threatened tougher economic sanctions on Russia, and Russia has said if those happen, those sanctions won't go unanswered. Let's first talk about what Britain might do. What kind of sanctions are they talking about?
We shouldn't forget that both the United States and the European Union have extensive economic sanctions in place against Russia already because of Russian behaviour over Ukraine and Crimea. I think that the British government will be looking at a range of measures. My guess is that it will include things like expelling Russian officials from the United Kingdom, tightening up British laws, perhaps, so that we're able to more quickly extend travel bans and asset freezes on Russian people who may be implicated in this sort of behaviour. There's also quite a lot of discussion going on about whether we need to tighten our rules on money which comes into London, sometimes from wealthy Russians, and being clearer about where that money comes from. So I think there is a range of measures which the UK can take. But I think Britain will also be looking for a measure of support from its partners, as I've already said. And my guess is that the British government will be now consulting with its allies, particularly in NATO, to see whether there is an appetite for further action of some sort in the light of this latest attack.
How does this affair compare with when you were dealing with Russia in 2013?
Well, look, it's moved on quite a lot. You know, if you look at the trajectory of Russian behavior, you go back to 2008 and the aggression against Georgia, you go through the annexation of Crimea, the attacks on Ukraine, you look at the consistent pattern of present-day Russian activity in Eastern Europe, where countries are facing a barrage of Russian propaganda, Russian attempts to undermine democratic practices, Russian cyber attacks. And we can see that we have a Russia which has become increasingly aggressive as the years have passed. So I think what is really important in all of this is not only that the British government responds to the circumstances around the assassination attempt on Sergei Skripal, but all members of NATO and the European Union recognise that we need to keep our defences in strong shape and we need to show resolve in the face of Russian aggression. That includes things, for example, like making sure that our cyber capabilities are up to scratch, that we are able to push back on Russian propaganda efforts, and that our defences are in good order.
So far, though, the Trump administration doesn't show much inclination for pushing back against Putin. How worried are you about where all this could go?
Well, there is an obvious complexity in the United States around the Russian activities around the U.S. election, and that is clearly a political hot potato in Washington. But I do believe that when I look at some of the very serious people in the U.S. administration, including people like the Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and others, that there will be a very deep understanding of Russia's behavior and therefore a determination to continue to push back on Russia's activity. We shouldn't forget that in NATO, where of course the United States is the lead partner, the NATO alliance has put more troops into Eastern Europe, it's conducted more exercises in Eastern Europe and the Baltics, and therefore we're already showing considerable resolve, and that is partly as a result of US leadership.
Simon Gass with Chatham House in London. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Just ahead, Muslim women break their silence with Mosque Me Too. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The Me Too movement has expanded far beyond Hollywood and U.S. borders. Women from all kinds of different backgrounds, as well as different industries and countries, have stepped up to break their silence about their own sexual harassment and abuse. And they continue to do so, often using the hashtag MeToo or some variation of it. Before we continue, a quick warning. Some of the language in this next conversation may not be suitable for younger listeners. Egyptian-American author Mona El-Tahawi started hashtag MosqueMeToo to give Muslim women an outlet to speak about sexual abuse they experienced while on the Hajj, the annual Islamic pilgrimage to Mecca. Mona, thanks for being with us. What sparked this need for hashtag MosqueMeToo?
The first week of February, Marco, I read about a young Pakistani woman called Sabika Khan and a Facebook post that she created about being sexually harassed at Islam's holiest site in Mecca in Saudi Arabia. Now, this was a sadly familiar story to me because back in 1982, when I was 15 years old and my family had just arrived in Saudi Arabia, we went on the Muslim pilgrimage, the Hajj, and I was sexually assaulted twice. And I've shared the story with several Muslim women, but to read about Sabika's experience and to read that her post on Facebook had been shared at least 2,000 times, and that so many women were still going through this awful experience of being so terribly violated in our holiest site, you know, during these religious rituals, really upset me. So I began a new thread on Twitter, and I asked fellow Muslim women around the world to share their experiences under hashtag MosqueMeToo. I had heard that there was a hashtag ChurchToo in which Christian women shared experiences about being sexually harassed and sexually assaulted, you know, in Christian sacred environments. So I wanted a similar space for Muslim women around the world.
And so what kind of responses did you get, Mona?
The responses, Marco, have been incredible, because very soon after I created hashtag MosqueMeToo, Indonesia, which is the world's largest Muslim country, woke up. So it began to spread like wildfire.
Like that same day that you posted?
Just 2 or 3 hours after I posted it. It was an amazing thing to see. And, you know, I would sit there and translate from Indonesian, you know, on Twitter. And many of the tweets would be saying, oh my goodness, I had no idea this was happening. Is this true? Is this happening? And then Indonesian women saying, yes, this happened to me. And then Muslim women in India and Pakistan began to tweet about this in Urdu. And then Muslim women in Turkey and Turkish and in the Middle East and Arabic and so on and so forth. And it quickly went viral. And the responses were, you know, very sad, obviously, and heartbreaking, but at the same time, really encouraging, because, you know, Muslim women have a voice. And if we don't hear that voice, we have to ask why. It's not because they're voiceless, because no one is voiceless. It's because they're not often given a platform, or usually the men of the community pretend to speak for all of us.
Did you get any response from Muslim men? Like, I don't want to generalize, but did Muslim men go on the defensive?
Oh my goodness. From the first half an hour, 10 minutes, you know, as soon as it appeared, I would take a screen grab and just kind of give the top 10 excuses. And the first one was, you're just trying to make Muslims look bad. There is nothing in this for me. It's incredibly difficult to expose or to reveal that you were sexually assaulted under any circumstances. So that was obviously ridiculous. Others accused me of being a Zionist agent. Others accused me of getting money from, you know, all kinds of people and groups that they claim hate Muslims. And this, of course, was all just an attempt to shut this down. My message to all of them was, it's not me or Sabika Khan or any of the Muslim women who make Muslims look bad. It's Muslim men who sexually assault women who make us look bad. Now, to their credit, some Muslim men have wrote back and said, I'm so sorry this happened to you. Because of your movement, I began to talk to my mother, my sister, my daughter, you know, and I've discovered to my horror that this happens, and we must have this conversation more and more. And that is really what, you know, one of the goals of this movement I began has been.
I thought hijab, the veil, the symbol of piety, was also considered something of a security blanket for Muslim women. Now, I don't know how many women in hijab have been assaulted in Mecca, but if some Muslim men don't recognize that, what does that tell us?
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons that are given to Muslim women to promote the hijab, which is basically, you know, to be covered up from head to toe except for your hands and your face, is that it will protect you from sexual violence, which of course is absolutely false. It won't. I was dressed in the way that I was supposed to be dressed, and this did not protect me. Because this is not about the way a woman dresses. This is not about where a woman was. This is not about sacred space or secular space. This is about patriarchy, enabling and protecting misogyny that allows men to sexually assault us. After I began hashtag MosqueMeToo, I began another hashtag called I Beat My Assaulter, because I was sexually assaulted in a club in Montreal, Canada. And this time around, I grabbed the man who sexually assaulted me and I punched him between 10 to 15 times. I beat him up in self-defense, and it was glorious.
You literally beat your assaulter?
I literally did, Marco. I grabbed
What was his response?
I think he was not expecting this, because he grabbed my ass and then quickly walked away. And I turned around in the club and I could tell who he was, because it was all couples. I was dancing with my beloved, so it was all couples around us. So this was the solitary man walking away, so I knew immediately it was him. I grabbed him from his shirt, and I think he was so taken aback that he stumbled. And I sat on top of him, and he basically just protected his head as I was punching him. He didn't try to fight back. And it was literally the rage of 50 years, you know? And I think that this hashtag MosqueMeToo moment is a really important lesson to patriarchy, but to people around the world, that there is a growing wave of women's rage, and we are putting men on notice. We are done.
When is the next Hajj, Mona? And how do you want Muslim women to carry hashtag MosqueMeToo into Mecca?
Right. Well, the next Hajj will be in the summer, sometime in August. I have a message to my Muslim sisters, and it saddens me to say this, that you're going to go on this very special pilgrimage, where, you know, it's the fifth pillar of our religion. And many of you, just like I did when I was 15, will think that you're going to the holiest place in the world and therefore you will be safe. And sadly, that's not the case. Prepare yourself for sexual assault. But, you know, in the meantime, I also have a message for the Saudi authorities, because the Saudi authorities administer the holy sites. Islam obviously began way before Saudi Arabia was a country, but the Saudis, for all intents and purposes, act like they own the holy site. So, okay, accept the responsibility that comes with it. So I would like the Saudi authorities to launch a campaign about sexual harassment and assault in Hajj. I would like the women guards that they have positioned across the holy sites to do more than just yell at women about making sure that we're covered up properly. I would like them to train Saudi police officers to be better prepared to help women who want to report sexual harassment and assault. One of the men who sexually assaulted me in 1982 was a Saudi policeman. And wow. This is even worse, of course, because he's supposed to, quote unquote, protect women. I would also, and this is incredibly important, I would like the imam of the Grand Mosque in the run-up to the Hajj, so ideally the week before Hajj, to give a sermon from the Grand Mosque in Mecca saying, Islam demands the respect of women, Islam demands the equality of women and men, and in Islam, you cannot sexually assault a woman anywhere, especially in the holy sites. And this is a sermon to remind Muslim brothers and sisters coming to the Hajj that women must be respected everywhere. That would send such a powerful and incredible message around the Muslim world.
Egyptian-American writer Mona El-Tahawi, great to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on, Marco, and for covering this important issue.
I'm Marco Werman. A Russian soldier is captured in Ukraine, and his mother pressures President Putin to get him back.
I want him home in Russia. How it's done and on what level doesn't matter. I want to see him, and I hope the Russian government will help.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Russians go to the polls on Sunday, and Vladimir Putin looks set to be elected president again. So all this week, we're taking a deep look at Putin's Russia, its wars, and its nostalgia for empire. Today, we turn to Ukraine, where Russians have been fighting a war their government won't acknowledge, a war where the lines on the map have become blurred, along with the lines between soldiers and volunteers. Here's reporter Charles Maines in Moscow.
On June 24th last summer, Ukraine's army had what passes for a good day in the war in East Ukraine. Just outside the city of Luhansk in the country's east, Ukrainian army soldiers had routed a group of separatist fighters, killing one and taking several others prisoner, including a 22-year-old fighter named Viktor Agayev. Video from that day shows Agayev, blonde with a scruff of beard. In the video, he's blindfolded and on his knees, surrounded by his Ukrainian captors. He takes a drag off a cigarette when ordered to. And here's the important point. While being interrogated, Agayev admits he's Russian. And not only that, he says he's a Russian soldier. He'd signed a contract at a military base in southern Russia, Agayev later says. He was deployed across the border 2 months ago. Then he says something about being paid. To serve is to serve, he says vaguely. Ukraine's government jumped on the story of Agayev's capture, and here's why. Agayev seemed to be concrete proof, and not for the first time, of Russia's role in a war it denies it's part of. What happens to Agayev is a story of falling into the void of Russia's so-called hybrid war in Ukraine. And we'll get back to Viktor in just a bit. First, I want to introduce you to someone else. Alexander Borodai, a Russian political operator from Moscow. Borodai helped carry out the Kremlin's annexation of Crimea. He's also a central figure in the war in the Donbas, in East Ukraine, where for a time he was prime minister of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic. Borodai is on the Western sanctions list. He's accused of war crimes by the Ukrainian government. He admits he was, and maybe still is, a hunted man.
Ну, никто не обещал, что, так сказать, мы вернемся живыми оттуда. Вообще, я считал.
And yet when I arranged to meet him in Moscow, he suggested I swing by a high-end steakhouse just a block from the U.S. embassy. No weapons, no bodyguards, just a guy drinking coffee and ordering one for me as well.
Скажите, пожалуйста, можно еще кофе? Напрямую угрожали всему населению Донбасса, например, и юго-востока Украины геноцидом.
Like lots of Russians, Baradai argues Ukraine was overrun by fascists during the country's Maidan Revolution of 2014, and that these radicals are intent on cleansing the Donbass of ethnic Russians. In fact, Baradai argues that people living in the Donbass are Russians. He points to history, dating back to Tsarist times, under the empire.
Дело в том, что, понимаете, можно употреблять слово империя, можно не употреблять, да? Но звучит такое слово, как русский мир.
You can use the word empire or not, but what we're really talking about is the Russian world. And specifically, we mean reuniting Russians who were separated after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Russian people, like any nation, they want to live together, to be united.
Now, this isn't just something that popped into Baradai's head. Nationalists in Russia have long pushed the idea of the Ruski Mir, or Russian world, a loosely defined territory where Russian culture and influence flourished at one point or another. Only these arguments mostly existed on the margins of Russian political thought, at least for most of the last century. That changed after the annexation of Crimea. These ideas, they suddenly went mainstream. Even Russian President Vladimir Putin, trying to pull Ukraine away from the West and back into Moscow's orbit, he started trafficking in the language of empire. He talked openly of the Ruski Mir, the Russian world, and of how the Donbass in East Ukraine had once been part of Russian territory under the name Novorossiya, the New Russia. These terms, they're dog whistles, and they're also music to the ears of people like Baradai. Ever since the Soviet Union fell apart 25 years ago, Baradai and others like him had dreamed of restoring Russia's lost sense of empire. They'd fought in the various wars in Russia's periphery, in Central Asia, the Caucasus. And now they rushed into East Ukraine, hoping to repeat the success of Crimea.
Ukraine is de facto a failed state. Back in 2014, Crimea and the Donbass were part of Ukraine. And now they're both de facto no longer part of the Ukrainian state. That won't change. The Donbass, ultimately it will become part of Russia. And in all likelihood, not only the Donbass.
These days, Baradai heads the Union of Donbass Volunteers in Moscow, one of several Russian veterans organizations that emerged from the war in East Ukraine. Or not quite veterans, not exactly. Baradai maintains, as does the Kremlin, that Russians fighting in the Donbass are not army soldiers, but citizen patriots, volunteers who fought the Ukrainian army to a draw on their own. And this is why the claim by Viktor Agayev, remember he's that Russian captured in East Ukraine, why it matters. See, Agayev said he was an active duty soldier, not some volunteer. And Agayev's story punctures Baradai's story, the idea that the Russian government isn't a participant in the war. In fact, there has been a lot of evidence to suggest coordination between volunteers like Baradai and the Russian military.
This armored column was filmed, it seems, not far from the Russian border inside Ukraine.
Journalists have tracked Russian weapons and arms crossing the border.
The view from the back of the bus shows pretty much a full mechanized battalion of the Russian army.
And whose grave is this? Is this Kachatkin?
They've uncovered the secret burials Kachatkin. Of Russian servicemen mysteriously killed in action.
Why are young men from this unit coming back in body bags and being buried in secret funerals across the country?
This is the exact spot where...
And they've located Russian troops in Ukraine through digital forensics, through geotags on soldiers' social media postings from smartphones.
He then put that photograph up on a Russian social networking site, and that's why we know that he's a serving officer in the Russian Federation's army.
Yet all of this is dismissed by Russia and by Baradai as fake news.
Я ни одной русской дивизии не замечал, честно говоря, за время своего пребывания на Донбассе. Все, что я могу сказать, вот эти все бесконечные, так сказать.
I didn't see one Russian division the whole time I was there. And all this speculation, all these people who say we're mercenaries fighting for the Russian government. If you make those allegations, you have to have proof.
Viktor Agayev, the Russian, he's proof, or at least seemed to be. And I mentioned Agayev to Baradai.
Это же не первый процесс такого рода. Да, это не первый процесс такого рода, они время от времени.
He's not the first case like this, says Baradai. But volunteers, they know the risks of being just that, a volunteer.
Государство не брало на себя ответственность за добровольцев. Государство не обещало добровольцам ни пенсий.
These are people who have deeply felt morals and went to war for them. The Russian government didn't take on responsibility. The government didn't promise them a pension, a reward, or any help. And if no one promised them anything, nobody owes them anything.
Украинская пропаганда жалко того человека, который попал в эту ситуацию. Но что можно поделать?
All Baradai could do was feel sorry for Agayev. Do you know how many people they've tortured in Ukraine? In other words, Agayev's confession had been forced. They'd broken him. But here's the thing. Agayev doesn't seem broken, at least not in this video released later by Ukrainian security services. It's shot from a security cam in the upper corner of the room, so it's a strange angle. But Agayev looks unharmed. The blindfold is gone. He's sitting this time, freely in a chair. He even looks kind of relaxed and says he's been treated well. The interrogator shows Agayev pictures Victor had posted to social media accounts, posing with a gun, group photos with other Donbass fighters. Some Agayev identifies, some he can't remember. He also asked what Russians think about the war. At first, people paid attention, he says. Now, not so much. And again, when asked, Agayev says he signed up with the army. He'd come to a military base in southern Russia before heading over the border to Ukraine on orders. But back home in Russia, a different version emerges. Russia's defense ministry issues a statement that sounds an awful lot like what Baradai told me. This is all Ukrainian propaganda. Yes, Agayev had served as a conscript, but he'd been let go after the service ended. It implied he wasn't good enough for the army, so he couldn't be a soldier anymore. And technically, this may even be true, says Pavel Kanigin, a journalist with Russia's independent Novaya Gazeta newspaper, who's reported extensively on the Agayev case and the war in Ukraine.
Agayev knew there was constant recruitment for soldiers to go to the Donbass, only it's being carried out informally by the Russian army. They gather there, they send them off to the Ukraine, but formally, there's no contract. Formally, there's no connection between Agayev and the Russian army. And yet, when Ukraine arrested him and Agayev said, "Get me out of here," Russia's response was, "Man, who are you? You went there on your own. It was your choice."
Or was it? Kanigin put me in touch with Svetlana Agayeva, Victor's mother, who I reached at home in the Altai region in central Siberia, some 2,000 miles from Moscow. She describes an ordinary kid. Her son was into sports, listened to music, had friends. After he finished school, like most young men in their small town, Victor went into the army. You'll probably say that because he served, he wanted to fight, she says to me. But he didn't have dreams of going to war, she adds. Again, he was just like everyone else. Pavel Kanigin, the journalist, agrees. Kanigin argues the Agayev story is a classic tale of life in a dead-end Russian town. Agayev headed to the Donbass, not for glory, not enthralled with ideas of empire. He was there for another reason. It was a way out.
Понятно, что армия для таких людей и для таких ситуаций является одним из самых...
It's clear that for these types of people, the army provides the only way to stand on your own feet and make something of yourself. It's a social trampoline. For Agayev, the choice to go to Donbass was about money. It was a chance to build a future.
But instead, Agayev found himself a pawn in an invisible war. For a brief moment, it looked like he would escape his fate. Late last year, rumors swirled of a prisoner exchange. A deal was even struck at the new year. Hundreds were set free, but Agayev, he was passed over. The exchange between the Ukrainian government and pro-Russian separatists left no room for a Russian soldier. After all, who could they trade him for when Russia wasn't formally even part of the fight? Instead, a Ukrainian court tried Agayev on charges of state terrorism. This 22-year-old from Siberia, who it seems never dreamed of war or empire, was now being punished in the name of it. During the trial, Agayev even changed his story. He wasn't a Russian soldier after all. He was a volunteer. The judge still sentenced him to 10 years. After the ruling, I called to check in on Svetlana Geeva, Victor's mother, and see how she was holding up.
Я чувствую себя одна. Да, правильно вы сказали. Нет. У нас этого ничего нет.
She said mostly she felt alone. She'd been to see Victor in detention once before the trial, but hadn't heard anything since. These days, just a few close friends and journalists asked about her son. No one else had been in touch, not Victor's Ukrainian lawyer, and not the Russian government or even the defense ministry. She still doesn't understand, or at least claims she doesn't, what Victor was even doing in Ukraine. You'll have to ask him, she says. Her thoughts are elsewhere.
I want him home in Russia. How it's done and on what level doesn't matter. I want to see him, and I hope the Russian government will help. Who else can I depend on? Only on my government. Only on my country.
As I was putting this story together, it turns out I heard from Svetlana one more time. This time through the internet.
Ladies and gentlemen, Madam Merkel, Mr. Macron and Mr. Trump, my name is Svetlana Agieva. Victor Agieva is my son.
She'd issued a video appeal through Nova Gazeta, the newspaper where the journalist Pavel Kanigin works. And as you can hear, it's in English, a language she'd refused to speak with me, I assume because she didn't know it well enough.
I ask for your help to find a way to release my son.
Now, she's clearly reading, but it's a plea. She's asking world leaders to help gain Victor's release by pressuring for another prisoner exchange, only this time directly between Russia and Ukraine. See, Russia is holding several Ukrainians from Crimea. They've been caught up in the Russian world, too. And Svetlana's move, well, it's smart. With Russia's elections just days away, there's a window, a small one, for goodwill gestures.
This is a severe sentence. Victor is only 22.
But I suspect it's also because she knows. Russia will never acknowledge its role in Ukraine. And that makes Victor a ghost who got caught.
I'm begging you to help my son.
See, Victor didn't understand the bigger game being played around him, but Svetlana does, or at least she's starting to, and she's haunted by it. For the World, Charles Maines, Moscow.
Tomorrow on the show, Russian ghosts in Syria. You're listening to The World. I think a lot of us can relate to the tension of staying true to yourself, but also not wanting to disappoint your parents. That's what this next story is about. Comedian Jimmy O. Yang has a new book out. It's called How to American, An Immigrant's Guide to Disappointing Your Parents. Yeah, because disappointing your parents is one thing, but disappointing them while two or more cultures are tearing at your identity, that's on a whole other level. That's what intrigued the world's Rupa Shenoy when she heard about Jimmy O. Yang's book. Rupa hosts our Otherhood podcast about the growing American multicultural majority. And here's an excerpt from this week's episode.
Jimmy's a great storyteller, and his book is a collection of the ones he likes to tell. The first is set in Hong Kong, where Jimmy grew up. One day, he and a bunch of other kids were at this media event where they were testing out ping pong tables that adjusted to different heights. Jimmy says the news cameras were drawn to him.
Because I was super cute and I had like really good form. And like my facial expressions, my body movement would look very professional. You can put me in like a ping pong movie.
The news people asked Jimmy back for a full in-studio interview and he nailed it. Everyone thought he was a ping pong star.
Which is very serious, okay? It's not a frat house sport. It's like the NFL.
But then he actually had to compete at like the state championship level.
I lost to like a local, like no-name kid, like 21-3. It was like really, really embarrassing, and I started like crying.
That part wasn't on TV.
But the word got out, like, this kid ain't got no skills. He just looked pretty good. I became like the laughingstock of the local Hong Kong ping pong community.
Jimmy felt like his glory days were over. He knew he was a fraud. In other words, an actor. So that's where Jimmy was in adolescence when his family came to the States. He learned how to fit in school by watching TV, one channel in particular.
Black Entertainment Television, which quickly became my favorite channel.
BET taught him American culture, American stereotypes.
Like, I didn't know like black people and white people did different things. I had no idea about these like stereotypes, but it was so interesting to me.
By the time Jimmy went to high school, he was talking and acting as much as possible like a gangster.
I was getting a 4.0 GPA cruising through high school because in American high school, they were teaching me stuff that I learned in like Hong Kong elementary school already. But I was at the same time, I was trying to be like gangster and I was trying to rap.
Things were good. And then for the first time in his young life, Jimmy experienced loss. His mom had never really liked it in the States. She took a job in Shanghai and moved there. Jimmy felt betrayed.
In hindsight, it allowed me to become more independent, become my own man. I would have just obeyed the Chinese rules and be a good son. I would have probably been an accountant. Looking back, it might have been a blessing in disguise.
If Jimmy's mom leaving was a blessing in disguise, it was a really, really good disguise, especially at first. Jimmy didn't make it into UCLA like his older brother or any of the colleges his parents had moved to the States hoping he'd get into. So he went to UC San Diego, where there were lots of Asian kids on campus. And Jimmy didn't like the sudden feeling of being categorized with them. So he tried to be the opposite of them.
I just started smoking a lot of weed and became like a stoner, because at least being a stoner gave me an identity. Being a stoner made me more than just an Asian kid or more than just a scared kid that's living away from home for the first time.
Jimmy's grades plummeted. He switched from his mechanical engineering major to an economy major,
which is actually the easiest major that's still approved by Asian parents.
After college, his dad got him an internship and then a job offer at Smith Barney.
I've never seen him so happy. Like, literally, tears of joy was about to, like, come out of his face. But I was devastated because I just see my life, like, basically it was like a prison sentence for me.
Jimmy had to tell his dad he couldn't do it.
And he was like, wait, what? Like, do you have another job lined up? Like, what are you trying to do? I'm like, Dad, I don't know. I just don't want to do this. And I'd already started doing stand-up, so I told him about maybe I'll pursue a career in comedy, in stand-up comedy, and he had no idea what that meant. We never saw stand-up comedy in Hong Kong. So he's like, what is that? You can't make money from that. That's not a job. You should go find a real job.
Jimmy found two. One job was as a doorman at a place that was a Greek restaurant by day and a comedy club at night. He did some stand-up there, but his mostly sexual jokes flopped. His other job was as a used car salesman.
Selling, like, crappy Dodge Neons to people with bad credit. That's what we specialized in. So we didn't need much salesmanship. Our catchphrase was, either you buy our Dodge Neon or you go take a bus.
Many of Jimmy's stories happen in this next era, and many of them are R-rated.
I got a job, which was like a dream job of mine as a young, impressionable 21-year-old. I got a job as a strip club DJ at like the most seedy strip club in San Diego. It was called Fantasy Showgirls, and it was run by gangsters.
For a while, it felt like a dream job. But that gradually wore off.
Like 21-year-old kid that grew up watching BET, now working in a strip club. That sounds like the dream. But really, I soon realized people that worked there, none of them wanted to work there. They wished they had a job at Smith Barney, you know?
He put all of his things in his car and moved to L.A. For a while, Jimmy tried to break into acting. He spent time penniless, desperate, depressed, until he started getting small parts, like on Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but he was still driving for Uber when he got a casting call for a new HBO show. They wanted a native-born Asian to play an Asian tech geek who, quote, speaks in a thick accent. It was Jimmy's big break. He got the part of Jin Yang on Silicon Valley.
I eat a fish.
I understand you eat the fish. But when you clean the fish, you can't just leave the fish head and guts in the sink because the whole house smells like a bait station. So you got to put it in the trash and then take the trash out. Do you understand?
Yes, I eat the fish.
Jimmy doesn't mind doing an accent, unlike some other actors of color.
Because I was an immigrant. I was the kid with an accent. It's snobby, and to me, it doesn't even make sense that you're going to say you don't want to play a character with an accent. Because there's real people like that that exist. So I've always almost find that insulting to me personally.
Silicon Valley got Jimmy cast in Patriot's Day with Mark Wahlberg and the yet-to-be-released movie Crazy Rich Asians. Jimmy felt he'd achieved a level of success. So he wrote the book he'd always wanted to write with all of his stories. Recently, Jimmy's dad, Richard, started reading it.
And to my surprise, actually, after he read the first chapter, he called me. He was like, this is actually really good writing. Like, I'm surprised. Like, this is great. So I was like, hey, thanks, Dad. So I was really happy about that. And then actually the next day, he called me. He was like, Jimmy, the more I read this, the more I'm not okay with this. And it was just like a really, really hard phone call, but I knew it was coming.
Jimmy's parents really don't like the book. His mom was going to take some copies to show family in Shanghai, but says she won't now. Jimmy says that hurts, but by now he's used to disappointing his parents. He says maybe his next book will be about dealing with the fallout from this one.
I totally read both of them. The world's Rupa Shenoy of our Otherhood podcast there with comedian Jimmy O. Yang. For the full story, look for Otherhood on your favorite podcast app. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, in a snowy Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.